All right, thank you all for joining us. I'm Katie Raholt Lane. I'm the president of the Federalist Society's DC Young Lawyers chapter, and we are very honored tonight to have with us here Senator Marsha Blackburn of Tennessee. We had originally hoped to have this conversation in person, but we are very grateful to the senator for joining us virtually tonight. Just as a quick matter of housekeeping, we're going to start off with a conversation between myself and Senator Blackburn, and then we will move into audience Q&A. So I encourage all of you to use the Q&A box at the bottom of your screen to submit any questions that you have for the senator, and hopefully we can get those answered for you. So let's get into it. Over the last few months, the United States has seen a tremendous amount of civil unrest. There's been violence in the streets, vandalism, assaults, and chaos. And perhaps one of the most troubling aspects of all of this is that many of our elected officials have appeared unwilling or unable to take action or speak out against this violence. But Senator Blackburn has not remained silent. In recent weeks, she has been a vocal opponent of state and local governments that have failed to protect their citizens. Earlier this month, she joined Senator Joni Ernst in sponsoring a bill to restrict taxpayer funding from going to cities that allow violent anarchists to have free rein. And she has stated recently that our government needs to take action to prevent the rage mob from taking over and destroying our businesses. But civil unrest is, of course, not the only issue that's affecting Americans right now. Senator Blackburn has recently spoken out against media censorship, cancel culture, the Chinese government's complicity in human rights abuses, and the rise of Marxism here at home. So we're very grateful to be able to hear the senator's thoughts on all of these issues tonight. Senator Blackburn is originally from Laurel, Mississippi, and she is a graduate of Mississippi State University. Prior to her time in Congress, Senator Blackburn was a businesswoman in the state of Tennessee and a Tennessee state senator. Senator Blackburn then went on to serve in the U.S. House of Representatives for Tennessee's 7th Congressional District. And in 2018, Senator Blackburn became the first woman elected from Tennessee to the U.S. Senate. Senator Blackburn currently serves on the Senate Judiciary Committee, the Commerce, Science, and Transportation Committee, the Veterans Affairs Committee, and the Armed Services Committee. So, Senator Blackburn, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
I am absolutely delighted to join you, Kate, and I hope that we'll have the opportunity to have a great conversation. I do wish it could be in person. Federalist Society groups are always a lot of fun, and I appreciate the interest in all of the issues. So I thank you all for being on tonight. And you're right, there is a lot going on in the country right now. And we're, needless to say, we are busy on Capitol Hill. And this week we're working on the NDAA. We had a hearing in Judiciary on the NCAA and what they're going to do with name, image, and likeness. Of course, the NCAA has kind of dropped the ball on that, if you will, and they are kind of punting that over to Congress, and we will probably give them a fix whether they like it or not. And I think that, of course, we're all looking at COVID and how we deal with COVID and also just the civil unrest. And to me, that is absolutely heartbreaking to see some of our nation's great cities just being ripped to shreds. And I know there's a lot of, you know, I think it really is kind of boiling down to, and I've told the president this, you know, we're at a stage where we have a lot of security moms and women that want to make certain that their families and their communities are safe, that their children are going to be safe when they go out in public and go to school, and that their health care is going to be secure, that the economy and jobs are going to be secure. COVID has had an incredible impact. And we've, in Tennessee, for every one COVID case that we have had, and we're approaching 80,000 cases, what we have is 33 Tennesseans who have been adversely impacted economically. They've lost their job, they've been furloughed, their wages were cut, different components of that. And but women want to make certain that our nation is secure and that our borders are secure. So I think security moms are back in full force, and it speaks to how people really desire to have a calm and peaceful nation. They want to see bipartisanship at work in Washington and in our cities, and they're very troubled that we are not seeing that.
Right. And, you know, you've been very outspoken on all of these issues, so we're excited to get your thoughts on as many of them as we can in the next hour. But just picking up on one thread from what you were just saying, civil unrest. You've noted recently that the Black Lives Matter movement is led by some people who have a Marxist vision. And it does seem like a lot of the protesters that we're seeing around the country have somewhat of a quasi-Marxist philosophy. And you've criticized this. So why do you think it is, when we're living in the most prosperous country in the world, we're seeing this failed ideology gaining traction?
You know, it is astounding to me when you look at BLM, the organization. We had some of Hillary Clinton's former team, some of her inner circle, really take out after me because I used the founders, the BLM founders' words, which was, we are trained organizers, we are trained Marxists. And that is deeply troubling that you would see that as something that is accepted, and that people would accept that. Because you're exactly right. This, after President Trump came into office, and after we did the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, you have seen the most rapid growth that we've had in our economy, even after COVID hit. Look at the way jobs growth has come back. I was just listening to the president's remarks at a press conference, a COVID briefing, and talking about the vaccines. Our economy is responding well, and knowing that vaccines are on the way and that they are coming about. That gives people hope. And to see so many that are young and just out of college, and to see them pushing for a Marxist agenda that would be destruction of the nuclear family, loss of private property, and taking away healthcare rights and economic freedoms, and just the list of other things that agenda stands for. To me, it is something that I look at and I say, this is a point of sorrow. This is not the America that I want for my children and my grandchildren. I want them to grow up free and to know what freedom is all about, and to be able to dream big dreams and have those dreams come true. And it is my job as a legislator to work every day to do my part to be sure they have that opportunity.
Right. I agree with that. And you mentioned, you know, security moms, people feeling unsafe with these protests in the street. And I think a lot of people around the country are feeling like their local and state governments are not doing enough to stop mm-hmm. this violence. We've seen a lot of local officials, like the mayor of Portland, mayor of Chicago, saying that they're really not going to do anything and they want federal officials out. Do you think that the federal government has a role to play here in quelling some of this violence that we're seeing across the country?
Well, these are local and state issues. The federal government has a role in protecting federal property. And pardon me, that is what you're seeing them do in Portland. That is their responsibility, is to secure that federal property, and they are doing that. Now, I think that Chicago has changed their tune, and they have asked the federal government for help. I know that some of the police forces have asked the federal government for help. But these governors and mayors these mayors of these big blue cities and governors in these blue states, they're going to have to ask the federal government for help.
Right. You know, one of the other things that we've seen, and you touched on this a little bit on, in your intro, one of the things we've seen coming out of Black Lives Matter movement is censorship on social media and online, the so-called cancel culture. What do you think about that? And what, if anything, do you think Congress should be doing to address that?
I have to tell you, our nation in freedom has always been well served by robust, respectful, bipartisan debate. Let all voices be heard. And that is one of our hallmarks. You know, we used to refer to it as the public square. Now, if someone disagrees with you, instead of thinking it through and saying, well, my point of view is this, and your point of view is that, they just say, you know, I'm canceling you out because you do not agree with me. And this is very sad to see this take place in so many universities, that you cannot have a discussion or a debate. You cannot have a point counterpoint. You know, there used to be, at one point, there were political shows that were based on point and counterpoint. And at one point, we would have floor debates that were point and counterpoint. But now what happens in the public square is you have people that will say, you don't agree with me, so I'm going to cancel you out. And I think it is very unfortunate when you see it happen to corporations, when there is a lack of tolerance for any different point of view. One of the things we have to keep in mind, when you look at the fabric that is so beautifully woven over this nation, it is the diversity that adds to that strength of that societal fabric. It is one of the things that makes us strong. We are all different, and we all have different points of view. And to the table, we bring different points of consideration to say, have you thought about this? Or have you thought about that? Or what do you think would be the consequences of this or of that? And you can have these debates. And I was talking with a good friend of mine the other night, and this is a friend who is a Democrat, always been a Democrat, will always be a Democrat. And the conversation went around to, I'm afraid to say anything anymore because I don't know what the people around me are thinking. And their point to me was, how do you handle this? Because they're like many Americans, they don't agree with everything the president does, but they have liked and benefited from some of the policies that he has made. And they feel like that just saying no to everything and trying to cancel out a different point of view is not going to serve us well in the long term. And another point of discussion that some of us had that night is, what does it teach our kids that are in college? That you cannot have a different point of view than other people that are around you. What does it teach to high school children when it says, oh, this child will not put something on their website, so we're going to unfriend them. There should be a desire to seek to understand and a desire to appreciate the diversity that is there because we are all unique, each and every one of us, different ethnicities, different genders, different points of view, different political parties, different upbringings. Learning from one another keeps our nation strong.
Right. And you mentioned that we're seeing a lot of this kind of censorship on college campuses where, you know, some would argue we need this robust debate the most. As you mentioned, I think earlier in our conversation, That's where some of these protesters are learning these Marxist ideologies. And so it's more important than ever that we have diversity of opinion and a diversity of thought. And that's, you know, that's something that's welcomed. And colleges and universities often receive, obviously, federal funding. Do you think that they should continue to receive federal funding if they're engaging in this kind of censorship?
Well, and let me say this on the protest. Peaceful protest is a very good thing. That is how you bring about change. And we want to preserve that and make certain that peaceful protest is always recognized. What we have a concern with is the protests that have turned violent, the protests that have caused destruction, that have harmed police officers. We have hundreds of police officers that have been injured. Some have lost their life since all of this began. So let's keep those separate. Peaceful protest would be protected, but this violence, destruction of life and property and injury and harm is something that the civil unrest that has caused tremendous concern in our cities. Now, on college campuses, when it comes to the free speech issue, there you mentioned the federal funds. And yes, there is beginning to be talk. If you're not going to allow conversation, then how do we deal with this? What is the best way? Is a restriction of funds the best way to deal with this? And I don't know what the answer to that is. I just know that there are many universities, there are many organizations on universities that are very concerned that you cannot have a diversity of thought and discussions that are informative in order to enlighten young people on different minds. When I was in college, I had some friends that were to the left. And of course, it's easy for me to say somebody's to the left of me. I'm the most conservative member of the U.S. Senate. But these were friends who were to my left, and we would have the most fascinating debates. And one is still a very liberal Democrat, but recalling those hours we spent in the student union debating the Vietnam War, debating different issues of the day, that's the way it's supposed to be, so that you shape your political opinions, so that you solidify yourself on your principles that are going to make a difference, not only in your philosophy of life, but your philosophy of government and politics.
Right, I totally agree. And that's, you know, what the Federal Society is all about, free exchange of ideas. Keeping on the topic of censorship, but shifting gears a little bit, you know, we're not just seeing this kind of censorship here at home in the United States, we're seeing it abroad. And you have been one of the biggest critics of the Chinese government's efforts to censor its citizens. So can you tell us a little bit, what is Congress doing to address this censorship and promote things like internet freedom?
Well, and our team in our office has put a good bit of effort. People can go to my website, blackburn.senate.gov. We have put up a white paper on China today and how you deal with China. You know, Kate, it was so interesting. I've worked on the issues dealing with China since I came to Congress in 2003. And I got into these issues because of intellectual property protections and all the songwriters and entertainers that are there in Nashville. And China was constantly ripping them off. And Gibson guitars, ripping them off. Auto manufacturers with auto parts, ripping them off. And this was a problem for us. So I started the Songwriters Caucus to teach my colleagues about this and intellectual property and protecting it. And what we have seen is the issues with China have grown because China has made it a business model to steal, to lie about what they steal, to reverse engineer our products, to infringe on copyrights, and they, rather than innovating, they have made stealing intellectual property their business model. So we were already dealing with that issue. Then along comes COVID. And one of my Tennesseans summed it up really well. They said, China took our jobs and they sent us a virus. And what we know is that COVID, they knew they had a virus on their hands and they had a pandemic on their hands. Watchdog groups say it was for 51 days before they said this is a pandemic. We know that they hoarded PPE from around the globe during this time. We know that they restricted travel from Hubei province. You couldn't leave Wuhan and go anywhere in China, but you could travel the globe and board an international flight out of Wuhan. Thank goodness President Trump had ended travel, ended flights from China back at the end of January. So they were not truthful in that. So people would say, after COVID, they would say, China is a problem. China has to be held to account. And then the third question would be, so what are we going to do about China? So this is why we did the white paper, and people can download it. And we look at recommendations for actions that we can take, whether it is returning pharmaceutical manufacturing back to the United States, which Senator Menendez and I have the SAMC bill to do that, or other components of manufacturing, or critical infrastructure manufacturing, or looking at telecommunications, looking at 5G, our military complex, some steps we could take there. Also looking at China itself and the how we deal, how our diplomatic scientists are going to deal with places like the Wuhan Virology Lab, or how China is going to be allowed to participate in global organizations. Look at what they did to the World Health Organization. And of course, we've withdrawn from that and we seek reforms in that organization. So these are deliverables. There's 129 different things we could do as we begin to unravel this relationship with China. We know that what China is doing with Hong Kong, they are censoring them. We know much of that is happening in Taiwan. We know that China is censoring some of their scientists who have talked about the Chinese Communist Party, knowing they had a pandemic, knowing that this was an issue with them. So censorship, or canceling out what you have to say, or diversity of thought, is something that is anathema to them. They do not want that. The Communist Party does not allow that. They want you in lockstep with them on everything you think, you believe, and you say.
Right, right, and I know that you've been doing a lot to counter China. I mean, you sponsored the Confucius Act and the Civil Justice for Victims of COVID Act, and those are all measures to counter influence. Right. I think one of the things that's been kind of circulating in the news lately that's disturbed all of us is the video of the blindfolded Uyghurs being loaded.
Yes. Treatment of the Uyghurs is devastating, and to see that footage, and the BBC is who had released that footage, and their shaven heads, and they're just being marched onto these trains. How can anybody not have something to say? Now, these human rights violations and this cozy relationship with the Chinese Communist Party is one of the reasons I have kind of gotten in behind the NBA And I heard back from them today. It's another reason that we are holding some of these companies to account that are doing big business in China or big business with Alibaba or, not paying attention to some of these human rights violations. And like the NBA, they benefit from doing business with the Chinese Communist Party.
Right. Yeah, I saw that you had made a request to the NBA for some answers about their relationship with China. And I know Senator Hawley has also been pretty vocal on this issue. I think he made a proposal that we should be holding some of these American companies accountable for having slave labor in their supply chains. Do you support that proposal?
There are so many things that we can do. Looking at slave labor, looking at the NBA, one of the things that we are working on is looking at should the NBA set up a charity and allow U.S. companies, U.S. small businesses that have been harmed by China and COVID-19 to access funds so that they either don't lose their businesses, or if their business got shut down, they don't lose their home. Because we've got companies like the NBA that have this very robust relationship and make millions of dollars. So why should that go into their profit stream? Maybe it should go into a nonprofit to help stand up some of these small businesses that have been so adversely impacted.
Right. I feel like we could talk about China this entire time, but I know we have a couple of topics.
China and censorship and all of, yes, those are definitely top issues.
There's so much going on in the country right now. It's a lot to talk about, but I want to be mindful of the fact that we want to get to Q&A. But before we do that, I did have a few questions for you, and I'd like to just hear your thoughts a little bit on this most recent Supreme Court term. And judicial nominations just generally.
Yes, let me talk about the judicial nominations first, because we have, we're continuing to push forward on that. We now have every single circuit court position filled in the country. It's the first time in 50 years that there has been a full federal bench at the circuit level. And I give Chairman Graham a lot of credit for continuing to push forward on this. We have tomorrow, we're going to be in committee and we're going to vote out some more nominees. And you're going to see us continue to do this. Yes, we've had a very interesting Supreme Court session. This time we've had some wins and we've had some curiosities, I think it is fair to say. And you wonder what causes someone like Gorsuch to tilt the way that they have. So, our responsibility still is going to be to keep that bench full. And whether we're at the federal district court, the circuit, or the Supreme Court level. I will say this, I think the D.C. Circuit or district, they sent the judgment back down, the opinion back down to Judge Sullivan in the Flynn matter. And Naomi Rao, who was one of the judges that we had confirmed at Judiciary, wrote that opinion, and I thought that was I was pleased to see that participation.
Well, speaking of Justice Gorsuch, sort of as you say, tilting. You know, if the president does have the opportunity to fill another Supreme Court seat, what kinds of qualities do you think he needs to be looking for in the next nominee?
I want to see somebody who is a constitutionalist, that believes in the Constitution as that document that underpins our rule of law. And that is the number one thing that we're going to be looking for, I'm going to be looking for, as we have nominees for every level that will come before us.
And I think probably the decision you're thinking about when we're talking about Justice Gorsuch tilting is the Bostock decision, which was probably one of the more controversial decisions coming out of this term. And that case has been criticized by the public and also from the dissenting opinions in that case as, you know, the court sort of stepping in the shoes of Congress, you know, that these Title VII protections, these were things that Congress had tried to do and hadn't been able to pass, and then the Supreme Court came in and did it for them. Do you think that there is any merit to the criticism that Congress has sort of acquiesced too much to the other branches, or that the Supreme Court has sort of taken on an outsized role?
And yeah, there is a lot of debate about the Article I powers and recouping those powers, whether you're talking about the executive branch or the judicial branch. And many times I say, in addition to the executive branch or the White House, you've got to pull into that the bureaucracy, because look at what they do through federal regulation and rulemaking. And the way you give them an inch and say you can do one little something, and the next thing you know, they have written this set of rules that is not anything like what was originally intended. So every bit of that speaks to the reason that Congress needs to hold their power, whether it's the power of the purse or in how they make laws. I say all the time, don't bring me anything that says such sums as may be deemed necessary, because that is a blank check. And don't bring me something that says, as you line up the rulemaking, as deemed necessary by the secretary. You know, these are things that just allow them to run. And it is a Congress ceding their authority to the executive branch. And when you have situations like Bostock where they say you didn't do this, so we're going to do it for you. In my opinion, that is something that is an overreach. And what we should do is jump back in, and Congress should have their say. And we should have our say on any number of matters where an activist judiciary has jumped in and said, we're going to say it for you.
Right, right. Well, I hope that your colleagues feel the same way. One last question before we do Q&A that I would just love your thoughts on. I saw yesterday that Senator Chuck Schumer hinted that if the Democrats take the Senate in November, I think he phrased it as, it wouldn't be off the table to consider eliminating the filibuster. Do you think that that's a real risk? And
absolutely. They've said they're going to do it. They have said they're going to do this. So if they were to take the Senate, they're going to get rid of the filibuster. They had already changed the rules around judges. And we have used that to our advantage in getting these nominees through and on the bench. But, you know, I got to tell you, that is, that's going to be the very first thing they're going to want to do, is get rid of the filibuster so that they can complete their wish list. They feel as if they had not had, if they had not had the filibuster when they had the House, the Senate, and the presidency with President Obama, that they could have gotten much more of that agenda completed.
Well, let's hope that doesn't happen.
Yes, we're working hard every day to be sure it does not.
I'm very glad to hear that. All right, let's go into some Q&As. I saw a few questions come in from the audience, so we can hopefully start with these.
Yeah, I think we've got a few more minutes before I have to go.
Okay, so here's one. This person writes, I know that you have very publicly had a tough stance on China. I see that the tensions are only rising today. In what form do you see additional sanctions against China for the coronavirus in Hong Kong?
Well, Hong Kong, of course, dealing, and the Secretary of State has been very good on this and very pointed in saying we have to change our relationship with Hong Kong because China has now violated the policy of two forms of government. So that's just where we are with Hong Kong. I think when you look at China, it would not be unexpected as we unravel this relationship to look at some of the sanctioning around some of the individuals. There'll be a lot we're going to learn around COVID, but I think the most important thing to do, and I would encourage you to look at the white paper that we have posted and go through that, because there are things, whether it's trade or human rights or healthcare or technology or military or dealing with China on Belt and Road or dealing with them on the digital Silk Road, blocking or eliminating these Confucius Institutes, which really are their form of propaganda. They call it their soft power and their propaganda. Those are still on 66 college campuses. They are in 500 K-12 schools in this country. They say they're teaching language and culture, but the Chinese Communist Party signs off on everything that is taught. So if an elementary or high school child is supposedly learning Mandarin in one of these institutes or one of these Confucius classrooms, what they are getting is a daily dose of propaganda in the things that they are being taught. It has to be approved history, approved language, approved culture, approved by the Chinese Communist Party.
Right. The next question is, there's no doubt that violence is an issue with some of the civil unrest we've seen around the nation. But he notes, as you just said, that there's plenty of peaceful protesting for more equitable policing of communities.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on improvements to the criminal justice system, be it in the areas of sentencing, federal funding for local police forces, data collection on use of force, and other issues like that?
Yeah, Senator Tim Scott has been absolutely fantastic on this issue and has worked for 5 years on a bill. He was very instrumental in the work the president did on criminal justice reform. And as you have heard the president say, and as you have heard DOJ say, that bill they felt like was a first step bill. Now, there are other things that need to be done. Our local police forces need to have some form of standardization in their training, because as we started working on the issue around policing, what we found was that there are 50 different academies. Each state has its own police training academy. There is no standards, best practices and standards in those 50 different academies. So there should begin to be some standardization that is there. Not federal overreach and not a federal police, but standardization of processes and procedures. Likewise, one of the things that I found out in a hearing that we were doing on policing was there is not a national register for police that have been decertified. And this is one of the problems that police forces have, because there may be someone who is served in a certain place and they lose their position and they are decertified. Well, they may go to another part of the country and then they bring in, they have been a policeman and they apply for a job, they get hired, they are back in uniform, and something happens, and it's an after the fact that the new employer finds out there was a problem, and this is someone that was decertified. So there needs to be that register that will hold these names and will show that they have, there has been this decertification that has happened.
Right. And that kind of raises a question that I think has been sort of percolating lately, whether or not there should be any limits or possibly an end to qualified immunity for police officers. I know Senator Scott said that that is a non-starter, but I'd be curious what your thoughts are.
Yeah, you know, I think it is a non-starter. Now, you all are familiar with different professions that purchase some kind of liability protection insurance. One of the big debates we have had around healthcare is the medical liability insurance that doctors have to purchase every year. What would end up happening is your cop on the beat would have to go buy an insurance policy, because losing this immunity would allow people that he arrests to sue him. So they would be in a jail system or a federal prison system using a taxpayer paid for library and researching and pulling together a lawsuit to sue the officer that arrested them and led to their being put away. So yes, Senator Scott has been quite resolute in saying that that qualified immunity, losing that would be a non-starter. That, you know, policemen wouldn't be able to afford the insurance in order to do the job. So what would they do? They would leave. They wouldn't do the job.
Right. Switching gears a little bit, one person asks, there has been increased talk on the left about DC statehood, and the House of Representatives recently approved a bill to make that happen. Yeah. Do you believe that DC can become a state without a constitutional amendment? And do you think, I mean, this goes back to what we were talking about with Senator Schumer, do you think that DC statehood is likely to happen if Republicans do lose the Senate?
Well, they're going to push for it. I think it would take a constitutional amendment. I think that that would be some hoops they would have to try to go through. It shows why it's so vitally important for us to keep the Senate, and it's why it's important that we keep the 60-vote rule.
Right. Hopefully we do. This next question is about the recent Supreme Court term. So in June Medical, only one justice called for Roe v. Wade to be overturned. This is one fewer vote against Roe than when Roe was decided. Is Senator Hawley correct that we have seen, quote, the end of the conservative legal movement?
Oh, I don't think we've seen the end of the conservative legal movement at all. You know, when you look long term at this, we've got wins and we've got losses. And when we have a loss, what does it do? It causes me to say, hey, we need to get back to work and we need to work a little bit harder. I really take Reagan's words to heart, that we do not pass freedom along in the bloodstream. Every single generation has to fight for it every single day. And so I get up every day and I say, I'm going to go fight for five things: faith, family, freedom, hope, and opportunity. And it is my job to be certain that my children and my two precious grandsons and that precious little granddaughter that will be here within a month, that they are going to be able to live out their lives in peace and prosperity, that they are going to know what the American dream is all about, that they're going to understand how those that came before them had the opportunity to dream up an idea and then be able to take that idea to concept, to commercialization, and benefit from it. That is a constitutional guarantee to us that we have the ability to benefit from our ideas and our creations. And I want those children to know that and believe it. I want it to be a part of their view of this great nation. So, you know, that's, I don't think that our movement has ended at all.
That's a great Reagan quote, a good reminder that we don't pass it on.
Yes, and I'm going to have to pop off and get on another call. But everybody stay in touch. You'll find us on Twitter and on Facebook. And even though Twitter censors me and Instagram censors me, we are out there. So follow us and stay in touch.
Thank you for joining us, Senator, and thank you everyone else for joining. I hope you enjoyed this conversation as much as I did, and I hope that I can see some of you or many of you at our next event, hopefully in person.
Bye-bye.